Hola, hola. Thank you for supporting Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. You know, if you like this episode and the podcast itself, please share with your friends because that's how we get noticed on the podcasting platforms. That's Apple, YouTube, and Spotify. Our handles are LatinasB2B. So follow us on all your social media and recommend this podcast. Gracias. Welcome to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom, where wisdom comes from everywhere. This is a podcast about generational wisdom shared to help build a bridge for future generations and to build stronger communities through education, technology, and health. Welcome to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. Today's episode, we are going to focus on the change narrative for Latinas in comunidad and just overall over the generations of how collectively we have been participating strategically in trying to provide pathways to access information that is going to be championing future generations. And my guest today is Valerie de la Garza. She has been in strategic communications and a beacon of social change for over 30 years, making her an ideal fit for our conversation today on Latina leaders changing the narratives for our communities, and to also champion our representation of leadership through organizations of change. Valerie's ascent to CEO of this 42-year-old powerhouse social impact communications agency, Fenton, marks a pivotal moment in the history of new leadership at this organization. Again, her career has spanned over 30 years, crafting narratives for nonprofit giants and consumer brands long before it became mainstream. So in our conversation, we get down to the critical need to expand Latino representation on boards and share our unique experiences while advising on diversifying boards by trying to look outside of familiar networks. And also we discuss the challenges of our Latino community as a nation as we're fracturing the foundation of our democracy. And also by the fact that we are calling our senators to save TikTok, but forgetting to stand up for our own democracy. We need to hold ourselves and people accountable for our rights as a community to healthcare, education, and living wages. We are at a transformational point in our leadership towards the future. Welcome to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. Welcome, Valerie. It's a privilege to have you on this show because you have been a Latina that has been around the block or two. And coming from Southeast Los Angeles in Southgate, growing up as a 11th generation Chicana, and also working your whole way into college, and then being the first PR agencies in the 90s where we needed to show representation, you know, you're here to kind of bridge that conversation of where we are today in media and the organization that you work for today, which is Fenton, which is a wonderful organization. If you don't know Fenton, it is a 40-year-old social justice and impact PR and comms communications agency that is here in the Bay Area, DC, and New York. So thank you, Valerie, for being here today. You know, the pivotal moment of your upbringing of why this brought you into being the first Latina CEO or woman of the Fenton organization.
Well, Teresa, first of all, thank you so much. It's an honor and a privilege for me to be with you here today. First of all, I'm a fan because what you are doing is lifting our voices. You are amplifying our stories that are important stories to tell. So I thank you so much for using that platform with such empathy and such honesty. And so you asked the question about that pivotal moment. And I grew up in, for those of you who don't know, Los Angeles. People tend to know South Central, or they'll know East Los Angeles or the Valley. And a lot of folks don't know that there's an in-between called Southeast Los Angeles. And it is a area that I grew up in, and my mother and my family are still there that I love so much. The working class, now very, I would say, immigrant Latino population. At the time when I was growing up, many, many decades ago, it was probably second, third, fourth generation Latino. And for me, that experience that you asked, sort of like, what was that moment? I would say that influenced my leadership and the goal of going into a career that would be about social impact and social justice. I can tell you, it was truly my whole childhood. As many of us know, there is a deep connection between zip code and opportunity, and often race and ethnicity and economics. And I knew that growing up. My mother on her side grew up only 3 miles away in Watts, California, in South Central Los Angeles, a family of seven, extremely poor, but very proud working class family. My grandfather worked in a junkyard. My grandmother raised 7 children in a very small home with lots of love, very little money though. And that means very little opportunity. On my father's side, as you referenced, you know, I am 11th generation, which is amazing. I'm so proud of that, that I know that information. A lot of us don't know our origin stories. And came here as a child from Texas, from, you know, a rural community, and, you know, came as this cowboy kid from the Rio Grande Valley to the middle of Los Angeles, downtown. And they met my mother and father. You know, their commonalities were many, that being growing up with very poor circumstances and very strong families, and came together at 19. And as many of our families do, lots of love, but there were things in the family that were not enough to keep them together. And the big thing that was in our family that was the secret for many, many years was that my father actually went to Vietnam. He enlisted in the Air Force and at the time did not talk about what he saw there and what he experienced and the missions he flew on. And that resulted in PTSD and later Agent Orange, which actually took his life just last year. And watching and witnessing that and seeing the trauma and seeing that, unfortunately, our people of color are often how we have so much trauma because we don't have access to the same types of access as we know, as many others do, to healthcare, to understanding, to education, understanding how we deal with these traumas. I began to realize that, especially when I went to college, that there are gaps, there are inequities, that I didn't grow up the same as those around me in college, that I was behind. And why was I behind? Even though I had, you know, I was a straight A student, all that great stuff. But then you go to university and you see those around you who have legacy, those around you who don't have those types of experiences. And guess what? They're ahead. And then you begin to see and feel lesser. We begin to believe narratives that we're not as smart, not as intelligent. And so all those things came together for me. And I realized, wow, I want a career. I don't know what it will be. But then through the journey of being a student journalist and realizing the power of communications, and then eventually public relations and strategic communication, I have an ability. If I've had this great gift of opportunity of education, and I have a platform in whatever that looks like one day, to be able to create awareness and hopefully change so that those gaps can be smaller. You know, those gaps between education and opportunity access, you know, as it relates to all areas of thriving as a community. So that's a long answer, but that's the truth is every moment, my entire childhood was about understanding that life can be better. It needs to be better for those of us who don't have the same economics and same zip codes as others.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that part about your father and going back to Vietnam. You know, there's a lot of history, and I've talked about this in a podcast I was a guest on for A Child Freed Latina with Paulette Arado. And this is shared also with my father, and that's the generation that I was born through as well. And it hurt a lot of families, especially here in California, throughout the nation. You know, we're the multi-Latino generations that have been here and that have been here before the border was set. So that's a thing. People think, oh, there's a lot of immigration coming from Mexico. There have been families here for centuries, and it's part of the way of coming back and forth for centuries. So this is a great part of history for you and me to share in a way that is like beyond first generation, that we understand the traumas and that we see that nothing has changed. The dial does not move, right? And why? So with that, you know, I want to talk about your influence that you saw probably going to UCLA. I've been to the UCLA campus. It's a little intimidating. So how does that experience, when you saw yourself as the only one, how did that bring the leadership style to you through the education? I know you saw yourself and we say, hey, we got to change this. Was that where you said, I have to change this? And is it because you were multi-generational? I think we just all say we're going to change this. And it just takes, you know, ganas and a lot of support. But where was it that you said, I have to change this narrative about this?
Well, I have to say that just recently speaking with my mother about this, we see this from data. Latinos absolutely value, whether you're immigrant or first generation, second, third, and they understand the value of education. The issue is, how do you get there? What are those opportunities? A lot of it is economic. Some of it is legacy. Not having an understanding of the navigation, just how to get there, right? And so families can have the best of intentions, but it's just not a natural understanding. It can be intimidating, as you just said, Teresa. And so I think for me, what happened, the transformation, if you will, my dad was like, you've got to go, you've got to go, you've got to go. So getting there is great. How are you going to stay in? How are you going to survive? So you get there. This happens many times within our brown and black communities, communities of color overall. We get there. We're so excited. And then it is really about that support system. And then what happens, at least in my case, I got there and realized that everyone was, I felt a lot of the peers were ahead. And then you buy into that narrative. Maybe I don't belong here. And that's when the very early seeds of imposter syndrome are sown. When you start questioning your worth, your intellect, your potential, your ability, and you do have to fight back. But I think from a leadership style, really what begins to develop, I think, is this is where the resilience comes. This is where the grit comes. This is where the patience. And I often tell people when they talk to me about mentorship, to try to push away judgment from yourself and to try to be curious. And that's hard to do. That takes a lifetime. I'm still working on that, to not judge yourself. And that's helpful as a leader, because you don't want to be judgmental. You want to be curious. How will we do that? And by the way, being okay with leaning in to sometimes falling down. And because that's the places where it's hard, you know, the places where you feel like, wow, I didn't hit the mark. I failed. Which nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to feel that way, but it is where the greatest learning is. And so I feel that college was that sandbox, if you will, because this is where, for me anyway, I used to get A's in Southgate High School, and now I'm barely surviving. I'm hanging on. I feel like I'm failing. That was the greatest life lesson for me now, and as a CEO, to learn that, well, you know what? I'm just going to get back up and try something else. That's where the resilience comes in. You know what? I tried this. Let me learn from this. Let me take this approach. That's where grit comes in. And being also kinder to yourself and not beating yourself up and saying, you know what? I'm not smart enough. I don't have that. No, actually, you know what? I'm going to figure it out. Just because I don't have that naturally, wasn't given to me through incredible education before I got to college. That's where the beginnings of leadership came. And then, of course, I was the first Latina editor-in-chief of the Daily Bruin in its 60-year history. Again, I had to fight back. I wanted to do it so bad because I loved the newspaper. But I had to say, you know what? I have to ignore the whole being the first thing, knowing that it's very important, that there's a lot of responsibility and there's a lot of people looking and watching, because we don't get all those opportunities. And I often say, you know what? We often feel like we better not, quote, mess up. But you know what? We're not perfect. The perfection is in us trying and believing in ourselves and trying over and over again.
Yeah, it's a resilience. And just kind of going back to where you said we've been here multi-generational. We've been here. We've seen a lot of resilience and that we can do it. It's just taking time to break this out, especially for Latinas here. You know, Latinas, a lot of us that have multi-generational families that have been here have had to assimilate. There's that assimilation process that was instilled in us to kind of keep quiet and just be present. So the breaking of cycles came through that era of the Chicana movement and when you were born to when you went to school to seeing yourself. You have to see the representation. You saw it in your family and it is sewn in, but it's by messaging that was not incorporated by us, but it was seeded. So it's really hard to break that. So let's get into that narrative change aspect, because I think that kind of pushes a lot of what's out there today in our communities still after all this time bringing up these movements, right? Especially with women. Why do you think Dolores Huerta is the only Latina leader that we see? Or it's like, you know, we see Eva Longoria and America Ferreira. Like if you said, who's a Latina leader, maybe Sonia Sotomayor, right? Those four. But in our aligning communities within the Black community, there's many leaders that you can see that everybody can name. So let's talk about championing the narrative for Latina leadership.
Yeah. Well, Teresa, you've hit on something that bothers me all the time. And, you know, I've over my career worked with lots of organizations, both as a volunteer on boards, as well as, you know, with corporations and in all types of organizations. And I was given the opportunity, I won't name them, work with an organization, and I was asked to help them diversify their board, specifically to bring Latinos, which I appreciated as a national organization. And I said, I absolutely appreciate that. This is many years ago. And they're like, we just can't, quote, find them. We can't find them. And I said, well, where are you looking? And so they provide the list and it's the same list you just ticked off. And I think that this is part of what we're seeing today with what we're facing in DEI. I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but you can have the right intentions and say, we want to have diversity, equity, inclusion. And I believe the intention. But if you're doing the same thing and you're relying on the same methods, well, it's not going to get you any change. So intention is great, but that is not enough. You have to have action. So I said to them, well, tell me what you're doing. And they show me the list and it's the typical folks that you would expect. And I said, you know, these are not the only five Latinos, you know, better respected. And I said, okay, wait. Do you have any idea? And I think that, well, we're looking at, you know, whatever at the time, Hispanic magazine or Latina magazine. And I said, so what you need to do is put an action plan together and challenge yourself by receiving people and being open to a wider pool and actually looking to ambassadors like myself. So I said, here's the only thing. I will provide to you a very powerful list of people in finance, of people in real estate, law, and so forth. But I will tell you that if you just choose one to be on this board of 20, we might as well not have that conversation. Because this goes swinging back to being the one and the only. It's a lonely place to be the one and the only. Because then you feel, well, not only feel, there is this whole like, let me carry the flag. And not that I'm not proud to carry the flag. I absolutely am making sure that our voices are heard. But because, you know, we are not monolithic. We are not. My experience as someone who's 11th generation is not the same as someone who's just parents or themselves who have just arrived here. And so forth, whether you're Puerto Rican or Mexican and so forth. And the organization, I said, I've got this person. He's so willing. He has the financial ability because there's a give or get on the board. And I said, but he won't do it unless we know that you're looking at filling these other roles. And he doesn't want to be the only. And they said, we cannot guarantee that. I said, then he's not going to do it. Then guess what? You're now in the same cycle. So part of what it is that, again, it will the intention meet the action? And I think that when you say, you know, why is it? I think because it's kind of easy. It's kind of easy to say, well, this is who we know. You know, I have to really dig in and figure out new ways and challenge ourselves. And I think for those organizations that have been very successful with diversifying, there has been some hard work. There's been maybe a little bit different work. Maybe it's not hard. Maybe it's just different ways of looking to diversify the pool. But I frankly think that people tend to do the easy thing. And that's why you see the same, same. And so we need to be thinking about different ways.
Right. And that's part of it is you're saying we need to think about it in different ways. Let's talk about how they think about it in different ways by bringing in the right people to think in those different ways, right? They have to find people because here's the message when I was in tech for 20 years, there's a pipeline issue. We don't see enough Latinos, and that's complete bullshit. They're there. In my opinion, it's they don't want to be challenged to that, what you just said, step outside the comfort zone to actually expand the thought, leadership, product, marketing solutions for your team, whatever it is, it's a risk. And brands are also being that way now, especially with supporting certain organizations, media. It's been known, especially during this election year, they're saving themselves from not looking bad, but that's part of it. You have to take a risk.
And I think that it's courage is important. I think that's what you're really bravery. And that's where the intention, maybe it's three ways, intention, action, and bravery. I, in our industry, public relations, communications industry, I have been in rooms that where people have said things. And again, I'm like, wow, well, we've tried things. So, you know, in our public relations industry, only 21% of people are people of color in our public relations industry. And it's obviously much less at the leadership level. And there's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of hand-wringing. There's a lot of concern. There's a lot of, this is awful. Isn't it too bad? And there's a lot of, oh, we really want to do this. And I actually heard someone say, well, we don't want to take the risk of bringing in people who aren't as well-trained because what will our clients say? And again, not as well trained. So what does that mean? You don't have the same pedigree of being, you know, well, you got to get a start somewhere. So people, I've heard people say, well, I don't know. And I've been, again, still the only in many of these rooms. And I'll raise my hand. Well, someone gave me a chance. Someone took a risk. Someone took a risk. And here I am now. I'm living proof to you that I didn't know what the heck, who knows, public relations, communications. No one grows up and says, they don't know, you know, much less in, you know, most forget people of color in general. It's not a career that a lot of people know, period. But someone's got to give us an opportunity. So, and we have that bravery and we have to be ambassadors too.
Yes. I completely support that in a way that says a thought leadership needs to show more bravery, right? And risk and just step outside. And a lot of people are afraid. And it's like, but you know what? You show a lot of courage in that thought leadership. And especially the younger generations want to see that in these organizations, that the leadership is taking the risk to support more of the community where they come from. But the diversity and the economics of this nation, they are changing exponentially. And we are showing up. So that brings up a very big question about truth platforms, about these narratives of our community, right? And, you know, you are in a very powerful position working with organizations to help work in creating that message, that call to action to say, this is the change we can be. This is where we can land as a community. This is how we build strength, right? For future generations almost, and by what I've seen on the website. So where do you think that shows up in technology? Are we the demise of our own narrative, or are we, or can we be the champions to change, you know, our trajectory for these future generations?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so proud of, you know, one of our clients that we worked with in the past, which is Unidos, who is dedicated to doing this work when it wasn't sexy, by the way, when it wasn't being talked about, you know, for its, you know, 50 plus years around narrative change and views on the way people see us. And I have to say, just when I think we get ahead, we go backwards. We know what's happening in Texas today along our border. And these false narratives about overstating, overthinking the amount of folks who are undocumented, which, you know, God bless people who come to help their family, risk their lives for opportunity. And so, you know, now we're being challenged by, you know, imagery. We move forward. And I think that what we're seeing in this country right now with this election season, and frankly, over these last, many years since 2016, has been detrimental to our community. Having said that, so we have to fight harder, and we're tired. Advocates that are engaged in ensuring that we have our freedoms, our rights, our privileges as Americans, whether you're, you know, Latino, Black, Brown, Asian, we can go on. We have to work harder, even though we're fatigued, and pick ourselves up. And that's what these next few months are going to be like. Our agency is, as I said, so humbled to work with change makers. Just two weeks ago, we just so happened to represent Resolve, the National Infertility Association. And we know what happened there in Alabama. And if that doesn't get shut down, and it's clearly, you know, there's a lot of work to be done there, guess what it's going to, what else will that will be a domino that can happen around the country. So representation, our rights, the way we see ourselves, or the way we can govern ourselves, our bodies, our portrayals of who we are, our strengths, all of that is under attack. All of that is under attack right now. And I am beyond thrilled that, you know, we're involved in Get Out the Vote work. Regardless of how people feel, whatever side you're on, we need to vote. People die and have died for the right to vote. And I don't know, we can't show up by not showing up. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we haven't been asleep. And the thing that you're saying is very on point about people have died for the voting, for us to have this democracy. People can say whatever they want to say, but that is why people want to come to this country. There are other places around the world where women just do not have the absolute right that we have here in this country, as well as men, as well as, you know, access to education. There's a lot we could go on about. But the fact of the matter is that technology plays a huge impact in this. And right now, people feel like they would rather try to save technology to their access to videos than to save their freedoms of democracy that their families came here for their education, for their right to have healthcare, for their right to work and be in industries that nobody else wants to be in. And they pay taxes. And yet people are being called to save TikTok versus their democracy. I'm just bringing that up because TikTok is not going away.
No, well, it's interesting. I absolutely agree. You know, it's interesting what motivates and moves people, particularly younger people. And the fact that we have social media, the fact that, you know, that is part of your voice and freedom. I understand and appreciate that, but none of that will matter if you vote, if you don't vote. You know, if we don't have access, you know, all of the things that are life, the things that you just referenced that are part of created our lives, our ability to have economic mobility, social mobility. And it has upset me why I've seen, you know, I've been reading about TikTok, and of course my children love it, and I love it, and I love, you know, and I appreciate social media as platforms, as bringing communities together, as being playing a vital role in democracy, as we know, but also in its demise in some ways too. So we see it's been dangerous, you know, it's a double-edged sword. But yeah, I would love to see younger generations, actually all of us, to channel some of that energy, that passion for things like, oh my gosh, I'm going to lose this, to what we are facing, a humanitarian crisis of epic proportion in homelessness in our country. And by the way, homeless people are Latinos too, and they're Black, and they're Asian, and they're white, you know. So this idea, well, you know, they, you know, who are they? No, they're families. They're our families. We're just watching this happen. And there, I mean, God bless so many municipalities that are grappling with and trying to do something about it. But I feel like, and again, maybe people, there's so much fatigue around the social challenges that we are facing in our world. But you got to think about, compared to what people get motivated around, I'd like people to not call their congressperson about save my TikTok to say, can we figure out a way so that people, humans, don't sleep on the streets.
I would even take it further than that, Valerie, that it is about homelessness. It's about the services that can support people so they're not homeless, right? But the one thing that really gets me fired up about this is that people are calling about to save TikTok. Well, let's talk about losing the right to choose for Roe versus Wade. That's gone. That's a huge freedom to women. Women birth 100% of the population or have the ability to. We're 80% of the consumer buyers in, you know, this United States. And we are trying to represent a better advocacy of how we can build power in a place that is not going to suppress our ability to thrive. And when I say TikTok is going away, well, you've already lost Roe versus Wade. They're banning books so that you don't know your history. You're already losing all these things. And I'm getting very fired up, as I said, because how much more do you have to lose? But you're willing to call and say, don't take my TikTok away. I mean, this is lunacy to me. Absolute lunacy. And yes, the homeless crisis is growing, but those are underlying issues that will only make it worse. And that's my opinion, but it is a passive sleepwalk into something very critical. And that's why we're both talking about voting. People have died for this so that we can keep democracy and that you can leverage that power. Seriously. And it's, we've already had these things, these critical societal issues that have been fought for being taken away. I mean, the ability to read about your history and the narrative around immigration and Roe versus Wade, I mean, it is time. I mean, we always say, you know, it's time to wake up, but we're beyond that now.
Yeah, no, and I think that I mentioned fatigue because, you know, we interact with a lot of advocates. And I think that, you know, and a lot of people will ask even our staff that work on these issues, how do you keep going? We have back to sort of getting ahead and then feeling like we just got kicked behind five more steps. But I think that there's an interesting passivity that we're witnessing. And I think part of it is having to do with the pandemic, which we're still getting out of. People sort of feeling like they are emerging still from that fog of what that world was like, or actually, you know, a different type of world in so many ways. I think that it's clearly affecting, I mean, we've been reading about, from a Gen Z perspective, a lot of anger, feeling like, you know, that they grew up at a time where things were kind of shitty and feeling like, well, what do I have to offer? What can I do? As I say, you know, when people say, well, I'm not going to vote, you're actually voting by not voting. Your sitting out is actually, you think it's an inaction. You're actually, it is absolutely an action that you're going to have to live with. Your children, the access, as you talk about, you know, reproductive rights, healthcare access, education, our ability to advance in all ways, all that cycle that we talked about from the beginning of this conversation, all of those things, housing, we can, you know, go on and on. Those are all going to be consequences if we sit it out. Sit it out should not be an option for anyone in this country, regardless of whatever side you're on. You have to understand and live with whatever you decide. You're a part of making your voice heard. And as Latinos, I surely hope, and there's been a lot of conversation around, we are complex. Of course we are. We're more conservative than people think in so many ways. We, you know, we have different beliefs and I understand that, but gosh, whatever side you want, get a vote. You got to get out there. You have to, and you know, for those who have the willingness to also seek out, and I say this to the younger generation, they are new leaders. You are our new leaders. You are the leaders. You will lead this generation. As much as we can say, well, you know, our parents, and now it's time for them to say, it's time to take charge and decide what that path is so that we, 10 years, 20 years from now, or whatever, 30 years, they're not talking about that the narrative is still the same, that we're still being viewed as gang members and the terrible things that people think about us as a community, which is absolutely untrue.
Yeah. Part of the thing is, too, it's like, how do we advocate and champion a new narrative? I always say technology is the most powerful piece. Everybody uses it every day. How you choose to share information is one way. That's my piece. But what is it for you?
I'll tell you that one of the things when we're working with nonprofits and advocacy organizations, that the number one thing is, and that you hit on this earlier, is to begin to look at life and talk with the community about an asset versus deficit framing. And, you know, you talked about some negative, you know, portrayals and things that are, you know, part of our story that are all negative and that perpetuate negative, you know, the stereotype. And I think that we buy into those things ourselves, whether that's on content that you see and what you choose to engage in and what you choose to put out there and challenge. I am on the board of Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles. And I can tell you, do we have within our communities, absolutely, gang involvement? Yes. But why? Let's go. We talked about so many of the reasons why. But what Homeboy does and what we do, it just is back to the asset versus deficit framing, is it talks about the stories of resilience and the stories of success. Instead of saying, we can't do this, actually, this is what we can achieve. People who were in those very difficult circumstances now have master's, double master's degrees that are running for office, that are representing their communities as being in the legal field, that are here running organizations like mine. Instead of seeing the negative part, we need to look and say, what's the asset? Where's the good? Where's the positivity? And challenge ourselves, whether it's when we're looking at our own phone and doing our own thing, to the organizations that we choose to be a part of, to the news that we choose to read and consume, and to the shows. And I think that that's something that is a very powerful message that we give when we are working with advocates. And I think that we can help turn it, and we need to turn it around for ourselves too, individually, and not believe that, and believe in our power and our genius.
Yep. Stand in your power and your genius. And, you know, bringing just real quick to Homeboy Industries, if you don't know about that organization here in California, it originated out of gang members that came out of, you know, incarceration, or they were changing, you know, how could they change with no family, no support, folks that have been torn down, and they're trying to change. And this organization gives them that hope, and they give them jobs. It gives them leadership skills. I mean, I could be overstating this. You know it better than I do, Valerie, but
no, it's true. No, it's absolutely everything. It's the point that we were saying earlier. It's not just intention, it's action. It's not just intention. It's not like, wow, we have a problem with dealing with gang violence in our communities. It's actually saying, well, what are we going to do about it? What's the action? And what is it that we're going to do to change our communities one person at a time? And now it's in 400 different locations around the world. Homeboy isn't just in Los Angeles. It's around the world. And that shows you something, by the way, of the power of what started as impacting our Latino communities to impacting a global community.
I love that so much. And that's where you go from the block to the boardroom, Valerie. Thank you for being on the show today. Is there anything else you'd like to close us out with in that capacity of that went full circle because you are on the board. You are on the board of Homeboy Industries. Is there anything else you'd like to close us out with in that full circle? Because I think that's amazing.
No, I just want to thank you, Teresa, because in part of the, you know, lifting up our stories, you're changing the narrative one person at a time, one powerful voice at a time, one Latina at a time. And you're using your platform to help make that change in our community. And I just thank you for that. And I actually say thank you for that power of your own genius. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Valerie, for joining us today on Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. If you'd like to follow Valerie and Fenton, you can go to LinkedIn at Valerie De La Garza and connect with her. If you'd like to connect with Fenton and learn more about their organization, you can go to Fenton.com. This podcast was supported by 5E Leadership and Marketing. If you'd like to learn more about podcast marketing for your business, production services,
and also how this could be a strategic initiative for your organization, please reach out to us at info@latinasb2b.marketing. This podcast was produced by Teresa E. Gonzalez of 5E Leadership and Marketing. Audio engineer and creative design by Robert Lopez. Please subscribe to our newsletter where you can find out more information on current events in your area, as well as networking opportunities. And if you'd like to sponsor an opportunity to be showcased on this platform, please reach out to us at info@latinasb2b.com. Gracias.